All right, why don't we go ahead and start? It is 4:01 and I wanted to give a moment or two for folks to join who might be a moment late. Hopefully everyone can join. Again, thank you and welcome everyone for joining. My name is Louis DeLucia. I am at Ice Miller and chair of the bankruptcy and restructuring practice. And I wanted to welcome you all to the National Realty Investment Advisors first town hall. We will be having a series of these over this next few months to keep people informed, some specifically targeted at just general information, such as this meeting, as well as others coming down in the next couple of months, focusing on proof of claim filing and the like related to process through Omni and otherwise. But again, let me give you some ground rules about the town halls and how we'll be managing these for purposes. There are obviously a lot of investors, so everyone's time is precious. We want to keep these calls to about an hour so that we can address things succinctly and answer some of your questions, but also not take your entire day. Second is that we have asked for and obtained questions submitted in advance. We've reviewed those questions and we'll be responding to them in part through our presentation. And also after the presentation, we'll go into those questions that we didn't address specifically. So many of them will be addressed in the presentation itself. All participants other than the speakers are muted. That's because, as some of you who might have participated in the first 3:41 meeting of creditors telephonically hosted by the U.S. trustee, we know how open mics with over 200 to 300 investors can be unruly. So at this point, we're going to have them muted, but of course, questions in advance will help us address your concerns. So again, like I mentioned, I'm Louis DeLucia of Ice Miller, and on this call, you will have representatives of Ice Miller, the Ice Miller team, who is counsel to the Official Committee of Unsecured Creditors in this case. On the call, I believe, are my colleagues, Allison Fiedler, Dan Polacek, and Michael Ott. They are here on the call as well, hopefully able to answer some of your questions and to comment as we go along. The Ice Miller team, just like as I'll be getting to the Alvarez team, is comprised of attorneys both experienced in bankruptcy, real estate, investigation and litigation, and of course, general bankruptcy administration. Our teams are focusing, obviously, on the real estate and the investigation and the litigation arising from what happened pre-bankruptcy, as well as maximizing the return to investors with the committee based upon the real estate that is available and to maximize that value in the current market. Also on the call is the Alvarez and Marcel team, the financial advisors and investigation team retained by the committee. That includes Andrea Gonzalez, Bill Waldy, Amir Vaid. They also are broken into teams that include investigation and litigation. As I mentioned earlier, there's also an investigation team that is being proposed for the committee that includes Rick Barry and Greg Coleman as forensic investigators as well. So these town halls are all scheduled on the Omni website. You will find a link, as you already have successfully here today, that link to participate in future meetings. There is also a schedule of those meetings. They may change. You should check that link periodically, depending upon what's happening in the case and or availability of participants. As I mentioned, we represent the Official Committee of Unsecured Creditors, along with Alvarez and the others who I described. The committee is comprised of seven investors and creditors. They are comprised of both investors who participated, like many of you, in making investments in NRIA, but also some general trade creditors, provided services to the company and were not paid pre-bankruptcy. So those are general unsecured creditors who, along with you, are on this committee. This committee is comprised of the seven members whose goal is and objective is to further the interests of general unsecured creditors and investors. The committee is appointed by the United States trustee. It's not done by any of us. It's not done by the court. It is appointed by the United States trustee, which is a division of the United States Department of Justice, and it's exclusively their discretion. The committee's powers and duties are profound at 1103 of the Bankruptcy Code. It provides that the committee can consult with the debtor, investigate the debtor and its business operations, which is clearly part of the investigation task, participate in the formulation of a plan of reorganization or liquidation, and perform other services that are in the best interests of the unsecured creditors generally. The committee does not, nor do its professionals, represent the individual interests of individual creditors. We are, in fact, as counsel and advisors to the debt to the committee, prohibited from representing individual creditors, but we can guide the committee through attempting to negotiate with the debtor in furtherance of the interests of all similarly situated creditors as a whole. So the professional teams retained by the committee, as I mentioned, are these three firms, Ice Miller, Alvarez, and Rick Barry's firm. But for those of you who haven't been involved since the beginning of the case, I'll give a quick overview. Some of you have been very active, some of you have been interested, some of you participated, but those who have just new to it, I'll give a quick summary of where we started, how we got here, and where we're going. And then we'll get to more specifics. So the bankruptcy was filed on June 7th, 2022. The case was really begun because of essentially a cash flow that had stopped because investors were no longer investing in the company. That was because in part they had reached certain statutory limits for investors. But in addition to that, the company had been under since perhaps as early as early 2021, SEC, New Jersey Bureau of Securities, and other regulatory investigations for potential securities fraud. Much of that is reflected in part in the June 2021 filing by the New Jersey Bureau of Securities cease and desist order, which I'm sure many of you have read. That document, which is available on Omni website, is a document that describes what the Bureau of Securities asserts may constitute securities malfeasance. So that initiated in part the petition that caused the bankruptcy to be filed. And the debtors immediately retained professionals, of course, pre-bankruptcy for the filing as well as after, which includes Sills Cummins as the lawyers and Eisner Amper as financial advisors to the company. The committee was formed in late June as the U.S. trustee did a strong, extensive deliberation as to who to put on that committee. And then we as professionals were not retained until July 5th. The company at the time of the petition was being run by Brian Casey. Brian Casey was brought in or about November of 2021 and was brought in part because of concerns and in investigations by the SEC and the Bureau of Securities to look at the company and was brought in through Pashman Stein, a company, a professional and a firm representing the company through pre-bankruptcy and now for purposes of regulatory investigations. He began initially in that capacity, but then transferred into a more management role as an independent manager in 2021, became the sole manager in or about February of 2022, and thereafter orchestrated or participated in the filing of the bankruptcy. The first day declaration that was filed by Mr. Casey is at ECF or in the docket number 16. That first day declaration, for those of you who don't know, is often a very good source of understanding what was happening at the day of the petition by a company representative. That document was filed, it was reviewed by all of us, and it reflected approximately $225 million in real estate with a value of up to $1 billion, according to Mr. Casey at that time, in the value of the real estate developed and then sold. That is, of course, not a definitive number that the committee is prepared to say is a number that will be realized in terms of the $1 billion, but it is something that certainly the Alvarez and Marcel real estate and Ice Miller real estate teams are assessing to maximize that value as close as we can to the highest possible. There are 18 properties according to the schedules as the filing as well as our analysis of the debtors. Your phone, somebody has their mute off and somehow there's sound. So please mute yourselves until speaking. So there are 18 properties. Alvarez and Marcel will expand on that in the discussion regarding the properties during this presentation, but there are approximately 18 properties. Six are under development, ranging from anywhere from 50% up to 89 or 90% near completion. Some of those will likely go forward. There have been motions filed in the bankruptcy case to assume contracts related to those projects, meaning take those contracts, honor them, and pay under those contracts so that the properties could be continued to be developed. So there are many properties that are likely to be developed. There are nine in pre-development stage that are less than that 50 to 90% stage. And those are the ones, along with three other properties under contract, meaning to be purchased, that are being assessed for value to determine whether or not those properties will be essentially worth investing the funds and resources to complete the development and maximize the return to all investors. That analysis is ongoing. The CRO and Alvarez are working hand in glove to assess and analyze those properties, and we'll get into more detail momentarily. Also, as of the petition date, meaning the June 7th date, there was $70 million in cash. That number has not gone down, largely because they sought thereafter, meaning the debtors did, the ability to sell $20 million in real estate, which order was granted on June 21st. Closings are ongoing as to the real estate, but they're not completed. So not all the properties they got authority to sell have in fact been sold or closed, but they are closing them going forward. We, along with Alvarez, engaged in a process that made sure that the brokers and others affiliated with those transactions were not connected to the persons who I mentioned earlier, alleged by the Bureau of Securities to have been engaging in securities fraud, individuals that were running the company pre-bankruptcy, such as individuals known as Mr. Salzano, Mr. Scaturo, Mr. Grabato, and others, Mr. O'Brien, that there's no affiliation with those entities as the transactions occurred, so that funds did not go to the bad actors. Those steps were taken. Funds were pursuant to an order that I actually argued that we escrowed all of the funds from those sales would not be used. And I believe there's about $8 million of that cash currently sitting there, not to be used for purposes of paying anyone pending a further order of the court. We also made sure that the real estate brokers who consummated those deals were not involved. That has been a process. After we became involved, meaning the professionals for the committee, we met with the debtors, we met with the debtors' professionals, and based upon our understanding of the trajectory of the real estate, the need for what would be required to develop the property, to look at the financing needed to consummate the properties, the expertise needed, it was determined that the bankruptcy date management, which included Casey, should be replaced. In conjunction and collaboration with the U.S. trustee, and I should say the debtors, Casey was replaced with a chief restructuring officer and a new board. The corporate structure of the debtor as of the petition, debtors as of the petition date, was really ultimately controlled by, or not actually controlled by, but as a matter of corporate governance documents, by Mr. Grabato as the sole member, but through pre-bankruptcy corporate documents, Mr. Casey was given broad authority as the sole manager. As a result, we were able to, through the bankruptcy court approval process, obtain the appointment of a CRO, chief restructuring officer, and a new board. The new board and the CRO were put in place for maximizing fiduciary duties to maximize the return to investors. We did not want anybody tainted by prior pre-petition alleged possible wrongful conduct and or misjudgment. So the new board is comprised of probably some of the most elite people you could have to make sure that everything is done properly. We have Judge Carey, a former bankruptcy judge in the District of Delaware, as well as former Judge Gross from the District of Delaware. District of Delaware, for those who don't practice in this area, is probably one of the hottest and most expansive bankruptcy courts in the nation, and therefore their experience is deep and wide. An example being Judge Carey handled as a judge the Woodbridge case, which has some strong parallels to this case in terms of a real estate Ponzi-like fraud case. So that expertise as our board governing the exercise of duties by the debtor gave us a great deal of comfort. Also on that board is one of the longstanding financial advisory and turnaround experts, Bernie Katz, who formerly in private practice as a financial advisor, who's also on the board. They retain counsel, which is Cole Schatz, also a preeminent bankruptcy law firm, advising the board simply to advise them on what they do and their fiduciary exercises. The chief restructuring officer, who's basically running the company, is John Fioretti. He has replaced Casey. He has decades of experience in real estate turnaround. That's his expertise. He was appointed with the consent of the committee, selected in part by the committee, the debtors after interview process, as well as the board, as the person, among other candidates, to run the company. When he got in, he began, as we mentioned, focusing on the development of a plan to maximize the return of value of the properties. He has since terminated 10 employees at the company. He has hired a new chief operating officer and is seeking the retention of a real estate permitting and finance expert as an employee of the company maximize those and basically putting in the right expertise to maximize the real estate values. He's engaging in a appraisal process to make sure that, as you saw with interest rates ticking up, with the inflation rate being what it is, the appraisals obtained months and months before the bankruptcy by the debtors may not be a sound basis on which to make a determination on the real estate values and the return to investors. So the CRO is in the process of obtaining new appraisals on the property to assure that the current market and the current trajectory of return is appropriate based upon experts in the area on valuation of the property. As I mentioned, he is working hand in glove with Alvarez on that real estate analysis. In terms of the, and we're going to come back to the real estate as we turn to Alvarez in a moment, but on the estate administration side, many of you asked, if not the hottest question, is where the tax information is. And what we can tell you, obviously, since we do not do the tax work for the debtor, we represent the committee, as does the committee not do the tax work. The 21 returns, the 2021 returns apparently for the debtors, for many of the debtors, have been filed as we understand it. And that triggers the K-1s, which are being issued apparently and sent out by Omni. So the Omni is the claims agent noticing person for entity for the company. And they are in the process of issuing those K-1s. So they are and should be in your boxes soon. The schedule is a statement of financial affairs, which are a key document for many reasons. One, it gives us a narrative of the assets and liabilities of the company as of the petition date by the debtors after an analysis by their financial advisors and legal team. It also states to you, some of you have asked, for example, where is the statement that says how much money I am owed? How much is my investment? That will be reflected on the schedules and statement of financial affairs for each of the debtors. They have 132 of them to file. They're going to start filing them in stages. They're going to have them done by October 4th, meaning all of them should be filed by October 4th. The reason for that is not because they're being, the reason is because October 4th, believe it or not, is the objection date for the United States trustees' motion to convert the case to Chapter 7. And the U.S. trustee said if they're all filed, they'll withdraw that motion to convert the case to Chapter 7, which is liquidation in bankruptcy. So that those schedules are being filed and will be filed. And as I mentioned in prior calls for other folks with the investors, if the schedules reflect, for example, that you are owed $100 as an unsecured claim, by way of example, and you agree with that, and it's not checked as disputed, contingent, or unliquidated, then theoretically, with the advice of your own counsel, you could rely and say, I don't need to file a proof of claim. But the advice of whether or not to file a proof of claim and what that claim should contain should be your own independent judgment and counsel's determination. We cannot give you advice on that. The meeting of creditors was held on August 16th. Some of you have asked about when the next one will be. It is continued. It will continue. The U.S. trustee has not what's called closed the meeting of creditors, so it is open and continuing. The CRO will likely be present, but it will likely not be held until after the schedules are filed, because traditionally the U.S. trustee will hold the meeting of creditors with the schedules and statement of financial affairs in hand so they can ask questions regarding it, and they don't have those yet. So once they have those, they will likely have the new meeting, possibly in late October, but I don't have a date yet for that. The last meeting of creditors at our request was of course recorded, as is standard, but we had it posted as well on the Omni website. So if you missed it, you can listen to the whole thing on the Omni website for the meeting of creditors as a recording, and you can listen to it all again. Proofs of claims. The bar date motion, the motion to set a date by which claims will have to be filed. The hearing on that is September 27th. The possible date that was requested was November 15th, but based upon the fact that schedules have not been filed and based upon the drafts we've seen, it's possible that the bar date will be December 6th. That is the possible date that it may be, December 6th, but we don't have that fixed yet. It's not determined yet by the court, but the September 27th date will likely be the hearing date when we will know. Look for and rely on the court-approved official notice of the bar date, the proof of claim deadline. Look for that on the Omni website. Look at that on the docket. You should also be receiving a form of notice. When you look at it, see it, and rely on that date. The Omni website is where you file your proof of claims. Prior to the bar date, we will be hosting two of meetings like this one to walk through the proof of claim process for those unfamiliar with it. And that will be, Omni should hopefully be able to participate in that and literally walk you through how to go through the Omni website and file your proof of claim. They won't necessarily, we will not be giving individual advice as to what your claim should say or attach, but that will be your own counsel. All right, now I think in terms of getting more granularity regarding the real estate, I will hand the virtual podium, if you wish, over to Andrea and or Hamir, whoever wishes to pick up the mantle on the real estate management and development and sales.
We just need, hi, this is Andrea. Yep. We just need Hamir to be
there. Fantastic. Yes, it seems like my phone was double muted, but whoever got the control going, thank you so much. Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Hamir Ved. I'm representing the Alvarez & Marsal Real Estate Group. For background for this audience's reference, the objective for A&M's real estate team is really to identify, as was previously mentioned by Luis, thank you for setting that stage, what the best path forward is for each property under NRIA's management. I know we talked about the property count and the segmentation in terms of how many in construction and what upcoming sales, et cetera, look like. But in all of that, you know, what our work really comprises of, is, you know, it's including but not limited to, a big caveat, is that we are gonna work through market comparative analysis. We're working through valuation. We are reviewing the construction status and the completion and the progress that NRIA's construction team has put forward. And then, you know, taking that into developing the going forward strategy, if you will, for each of the properties in a manner that we can then compare and analyze the most accretive exits for these properties, and accretive being for the investors and the property values as a whole. So that's been the mandate. You know, A&M was appointed as financial advisors, as most of you will know, in July of 2022. And what we've really accomplished thus far are threefold items, and I will, you know, go from there in terms of the update. Time-wise, some of the work once A&M was appointed was the pre-appointment of the CRO. So at that point in time, this was around July through sometime in August. What A&M was focusing on from a real estate standpoint was working through the contract, construction contract assumption motion. So we worked with NRIA and their construction team, looking at all of the construction contracts that were itemized to be assumed for the vendors. We provided our opinion and reviews on that context. And in parallel, we were working on requirements gathering across all of the properties that were currently remain to be under NRIA's management, which meant we took in the financial analyses that were provided to us by the Casey Group, the existing analyses that the incumbent NRIA teams have on hand, et cetera. And since then, you know, once the CRO was appointed, we've been working very collaboratively with the CRO and the NRIA team, taking that to the next level where we had the opportunity to visit all of the properties that are under management. We took a hard look at the underlying local market conditions for those properties. So meeting with the local brokerage network, speaking with some of the subcontractor teams, most of the general contractor teams, doing some interviews on the ground for our reference, as well as then mapping that back to, you know, what was said and provided to us in terms of where these properties are from a construction status relative to cost point of view. In that, you know, we were able to develop by property reports, very preliminary, and I will qualify that with the assumption that the analysis that was included in that property summary was based upon what was provided to us by NRIA with some adjustments based on our reviews. The construction draws that NRIA has conducted thus far across all assets, which means the monies that they have taken, you know, allocated towards the loan draws towards the construction payments, and then some ancillary analyses that we are stress testing to quantify what has been presented thus far. And then finally, I'll take a pause after this. What we do plan to go forward and continuing to do so is, again, working with the CRO and the NRIA team in developing a by-property strategy going forward. And what that really is taking all of the materials that we have gathered, the interviews we've conducted, the site visits that we've conducted, and then providing our independent opinion on how we analyze these assets, you know, should there be a construction completion requirement for one of the assets, which has a very favorable market and, you know, would be a good exit in the short term. We are going to put together a valuation behind that and come up with our marks. And similarly, you know, works around the list collaboratively with the CRO. And that exercise is about the next 60 to 90 days. And we'll continue to report as progress occurs.
Thank you, Hamir. Before we jump into the investigation, let me start with this. Recognize that some of the work that is required to be done and has been done immediately as of the petition date, and actually after the appointment, which is July 5th. So we're now in the August, September, you know, 2.5 months into the case, is recognizing that the company's records were in somewhat of a disarray as of the petition date. There's an enormous amount of unraveling what the records look like in order to come up with an accurate picture before the analysis could be done. So a lot of that work is behind the scenes. The product of work that you're going to be seeing will be probably more prospective, both in the investigation side, and we'll talk about subpoenas in a second, as well as the real estate side, where a lot of the homework was done visiting the properties, assessing the properties. We couldn't rely on, as recently as February and earlier, analysis or work done by any of the Gravato or other team, because clearly you're in this position because they made certain representations that were apparently not accurate. This is why this team is here, and it's taken some time to do that homework. So I'll turn it back over on an important piece also, which is the investigation to Alvarez. Bill? We need to unmute Bill.
There we go.
There you go.
All right. Yep. Hi, can you hear me? Okay. Yeah, I'm Bill Waldy. I'm a managing director at Alvarez & Marsal in the disputes and investigations practice. I'm heading the investigations portion, working with the rest of our team in ICE on this project. As far as the investigation goes, what you need to understand is that this is a target approach that we use. There's numerous work streams going on, but in order to get our arms around this, the first thing we had to do is obtain an understanding of the business, the current and past employees, their roles, the perceived and known accounting and financial issues, and other information that's out there that can help us unravel what happened here. And this is done in a number of ways, right? So, you know, initially what we do is we meet with people, we conduct interviews, we talk with personnel to get their perspective, what happened, and get background information. That has been very fruitful in obtaining information from people who are still on staff or were on staff there, where we can get information. Also, document review, reviewing everything that's out there in the public, cease and desist orders, so forth. Everything that's out there, we go. The other thing we do is we perform what we call business intelligence. And what I mean by business intelligence is we look at the key insiders and we do a deep dive background into all of them. And what has that resulted in? As a result of digging into these people, what we do is we've identified an additional, overall more than 290 insider connections and entities that connect to the main players that everybody knows were named and organized, you know, the alleged fraud. We also perform ad hoc diligence in connection with the ordinary course professionals, contracts to assume to make sure that before any of those deals are struck, that none of those parties are connected to the known insiders as we build out this matrix. This is an ongoing process. It's constantly shifting and evolving, and it's something that we do. With the intelligence, we generate reports. And these are detailed written reports that we provide to counsel and the team to help us with our investigation. This helps us understand their background, their known relations, current prior addresses, contact info, any litigations that are out there, liens, assets, real property, social media presence, and so forth that's out there. That's how we were able to identify these connections. This also helps us with what the financial analysis. And to me, that's the most important part of the investigation is following the money. What happened with this money and where did it go? And what we're dealing with here is about 119 bank accounts. Now, all the bank accounts aren't equal, some more active than others. That's what I mean by a targeted approach. We look at the more active accounts. We look for certain red flags. We look for certain unusual transactions, large transactions, who those transactions were with. So part of that is identifying the transfers of funds, the sources of funds, the parties that received those funds, bank accounts that were involved in those funds, and where Lewis mentioned subpoenas, what we do is we follow that money to other accounts. We identify those accounts, and we see we identify the bank account info, the account numbers, and so forth that we think are relevant. We then put forth subpoena requests. Subpoenas go out to those banks so we can get the next layer as to how that money moves, because these are going to be layered transactions. It's not going to only be from the debtor accounts, but it's going to be from accounts that were affiliated with them or associated with insiders or others connected to those insiders. So we trace that money out, identify those accounts. Just with the debtor accounts now, we're looking at about right now loaded in about 156,000 statement pages, which just in the books and records amount to about 51,000 disbursements, which we're going through. We've put out over 60 bank subpoena requests so far. We've been analyzing the disbursements to understand what was paid, what the expenses are for, the parties involved, how they're related to an insider. Was it commensurate? Was it unusual? Did it make sense? So we can try to claw back that money later. We do track all of, we don't think that any of the investor complaints that are coming in to ICE aren't being tracked and used for leads and follow-up purposes. We're keeping a close eye on that as we maintain that matrix as well. And then we're also assisting in the development of claims and causes of action to help recover assets out there, as we understand that the real goal here in following the money is to find out where that money went, where there are real assets out there, where are there funds out there that we could claw back to help try to make you guys whole at the end of the day. But that's a high level overview of where we stand right now in the investigation.
Thanks, Bill. Before I turn it over to Mike on the subpoenas real quickly, I just wanted to give two summary statements regarding the real estate, so the schedules and the investigation real quickly. And that is, the schedules, just so you understand what they are, and the statement of financial affairs, those are that is a document prepared by the debtors that says this is what we owned and owed to creditors as of the petition date. It is a static picture of the assets as of that date. The 4 to 6 weeks in the project that the CRO is, as well as Alvarez, is working on is one of how do we take those assets at whatever real value exists and current status of development and maximize that return. So that, and the value of those assets, is it better on a particular property to develop it? Is it better to sell it as is? Is it better to do it a different way? And all aspects, all options are being considered. That includes, for example, a sale of the asset as is to a individual assets by individual particular parties to a particular person. Second is parties with interest in lending into the facility with a shared return are being talked to. People who may be interested in buying the portfolio may be considered as they come along. So the entire process is being vetted as a way of maximizing the return. And that's the goal of everyone here, which is find the best option to take every asset and every dollar and maximize the return to you. So all of those are being considered. There is no discrepancy between schedules and the plan 4 to 6 weeks. That's not on the same path. Second is on the investigation. The reason why it takes a while and why those reports are not always available to you is that's litigation preparatory material. You are, although investors here, generally not under the attorney-client privilege. And if we share information with you that could get in the hands of the wrong actors, that opens up the availability for them to pierce and get into our investigation and then impairs our ability to use that litigation to maximize a return to you. So we have to be careful about those reports getting in the wrong hands. I can tell you that there are extensive reports on the investigation that are very deep and detailed, names, places, accounts, conversations. And yet, but we can't share that with everybody until we commence litigation and it becomes public. So with that, the litigation has really two or three phases. The first is the investigatory piece, which kind of spills over and continues in the litigation. The second is the formal investigation, which is the depositions and the discovery of documents through formal discovery, which has begun. Michael talked about that. And lastly is, once we begin litigation, people will have to respond to that litigation. We'll have depositions. Even before litigation, we'll have depositions under Bankruptcy Rule 2004, which Mike will talk about. And then we'll go from there. So Mike, go ahead.
Sure. Thanks, Lewis. So the Bankruptcy Code, one of the things it provides is a creditor committee with a great deal of latitude to perform discovery, to request documents, to submit subpoenas to interested parties that have information about the debtor's assets. It allows the creditors committee to, in effect, perform a fishing expedition for anything and everything of relevance with respect to that. So as we've been working with Alvarez to investigate and determine who are the appropriate targets of that investigation, we have submitted at this point about 20 subpoenas to various banks, financial institutions, and other relevant parties for information with respect to the, you know, potential wrongdoers' bank accounts and other aspects of their. One thing to keep in mind in this case is that they filed on the petition date their declaration saying that there were about $550 million of investor claims and only about $250 million of real estate assets, plus about $72 million in cash. So the question is, where did that cash go? The preliminary stages of our investigation have shown us that it did not all go to one place. This isn't a bucket with a single hole in the bottom where the cash is just coming out. We can find that one place it's going to. This is more of a colander. The cash went out all sorts of different places. And so we need to pursue multiple avenues to determine where we can get that cash, get that money back, and what the recoveries can be. So we are pursuing that vigorously in terms of first documents, which we need to review and prepare before we can start asking questions and depositions and other interviews to determine where those assets went, what claims we may have on, you know, under New Jersey and federal law in order to recover those claims for investors, and what the best and most efficient avenue to proceed is.
Thanks, Mike. And that process is a 30 to and more days for property, for the information to come back to us to be, then we have to analyze it. Then we take depositions. So it's going to be a process to pursue those claims. There are going to be transfers of assets that we're going to claw back from third parties who took those assets, bought property, et cetera. So those causes of action will be developed over the next few months. There are important dates, however, in the interim that you should know about. One is that there are hearings coming up on the 27th of September. There are several motions on that day. I know that it is an important date and a holiday for many. Those hearings are transcribed into transcripts, and those transcripts are available on the docket, but they cost, but we as the committee should be able to obtain those. So the September 27th hearing is going forward. There are several motions on for that day. The most important of which is the bar date motion I mentioned earlier, which will be setting the either November 15th or possibly December 6th date as a bar date motion. That will be an important order once it's entered, and it will be on the Omni docket, and notice will be issued. And there will likely be publications in newspapers of that bar date as well for investors across the country. There are motions for stay relief, meaning relief from the automatic stay that is imposed immediately upon the bankruptcy. Once the bankruptcy is filed, an automatic stay goes into place, preventing people from suing or going after the debtor or its property. There are two motions asking for relief from that stay, one by the YMCA of the Oranges and one by a property buyer at 124 North Krosky Street in Philadelphia. They basically, those are two properties under which the debtor is in a contract for the sale of or of purchase of property. They want relief in order to terminate the contracts. The debtor opposed that relief. We'll be joining in the opposition and responding to it by the September 27th hearing date. Excuse me. There is also a U.S. construction motion to compel performance. U.S. construction is an entity run by a person affiliated, the son of Nicholas Salzano, an individual known as Dustin Salzano, as well as another individual. That entity is the subject of litigation, but is going to be the subject of further litigation. They are parties who sought initially to terminate or to enforce a contract and have the property developed. The property is proceeding, but there are negotiations that are ongoing, the details of which we're not free to disclose, that will likely lead to the development of the property down in Florida, Del Rey, and we will likely see the property developed, but not have necessarily U.S. construction remain involved. But that is ongoing negotiations, and it will be memorialized likely by the time we get to the hearing on the 27th. There's also a hearing on October 4th. That hearing is the motion to extend exclusivity by the debtors. Exclusivity is the exclusive period under 1121 of the Bankruptcy Code in which only the debtor may file a plan of reorganization. It's called the exclusive period. Plan of liquidation or plan of plan of reorganization or liquidation. That's at docket number 605 if you wish to read it. They're requesting 120 days or 240 total for the first 120 days, which is automatic, then an extension for another 120 days, which will put their period to the exclusive period to February 2nd, 2023. The committee is analyzing whether or not it wishes to shorten the additional extension of 120 days But we are, just so you understand, working very closely with the debtors on crafting the plan. The plan is not, certainly there's a lot of work to be done before a plan can actually be filed. These investigations need to mature, the real estate strategy needs to mature, but even more importantly, the proof of claims have to be filed and the schedules have to be filed before the plan can really go further. But we are in the process of working with them. So what they're doing by extending the period is not necessarily bad. An example being that if exclusivity is not extended and it ends, then theoretically any party in interest, which includes Gravato, could file a plan, and nobody wants that. So the reality is we will have likely some compromise on the motion for extending exclusivity to preserve the status quo as we work with the debtor to formulate a plan. There's also a motion to extend time to assume or reject unexpired leases. That is also an extent, that's docket number 604, if you wish to read it. It requests 90 days extra. Now, what that means is when a debtor files for bankruptcy, it has the ability to assume, meaning take on and agree to honor and go forward with a contract, or reject it, which is like saying, I'm going to breach the contract, you can have a claim against me, and it's essentially, from a practical standpoint, not legally, terminated. So they're going to seek to extend the period to make a decision on that, but the CRO, Chief Restructuring Officer, is making certain decisions about the real estate office space that he's considering how to address, which is an office lease to save money, reduce the space, reduce the contract exposure, so that we have less claims against the estate. So that is ongoing, and that motion addresses that. October 11th is the U.S. Trustee's motion to convert. That again is tied just because the schedules haven't been filed, and there's a statement within that document, which is at docket number 600, if you wish to read it. That document says essentially if the schedules are filed, they'll withdraw the motion. When I say docket number, if you go onto the Omni website for free, you can see these documents. It's on the Omni website, you can see them. There's also a motion for the appointment of an independent fee examiner. What we understand is that motion comes about because of a compromise made by the debtor with the U.S. trustee in conjunction with the appointment of the CRO. Fee examiners are often appointed in large cases like this, where there are multiple professionals, to relieve to some degree the U.S. trustee and others of the burden of reviewing everybody's fee applications. And it creates, meaning the applications by the professionals to be paid out of the court. And it's a way of making sure that the, approved by the court, so that the fees can be paid. The fee examiner reviews the statements, reviews the time entries, makes sure they're compliant with the bankruptcy code and reasonable, and then reports to the court and allows the fees to be paid or reduced. And that's what the fee examiner does. We are not completely satisfied with the motion because it authorizes the fee examiner, as I saw it, to hire counsel. We don't need another layer of professionals in the case. We don't need more professionals in the case. So if we can try to cut back a little bit on that burden, we're going to try to do that. All right, resources. There's the Omni website. I told you about that. For those who don't know about the Omni website, happy to address that or give you that website separately. But that Omni website is at, if you just Google Omni Agent Solutions, and then look for the, under cases, you'll see National Realty Investment Advisors on the upper right. You'll drop down for cases and you'll see everything there. There is a creditors committee webpage page or block on that webpage. Information is posted there by us. There's a US Bankruptcy Court webpage, of course, has a docket through PACER that is also available, but you have to have a code to get in. And there's also the US Trustee page that provides information. As I mentioned, we have a number of questions that were put through the registration process that we'll attempt to walk through answers for. Some of them, as I mentioned, have been answered through our discussion. We've already answered the question about the K-1s. One question is, was my investment secured by real estate? That depends upon your individual documents. We cannot tell you whether or not your interest is secured by real estate unless you take a look. We are aware of according to the reports by the debtor, and as part of our process is still being confirmed, there are three secured creditors, major secured creditors, on real estate subject to development, but not a vast number of investors. You know, there aren't as many secured creditors showing up as there are investors. So the reality is you have to look at your specific documents and whether or not you took steps under applicable law to perfect your lien. Speak to your lawyer, look at your documents to decide whether or not you truly have a security interest. There's a lot to do to get a perfected security interest. Are there assurances that NRIA's records are accurate as to each investor? Certainly that's part of the work of the forensic team, financial forensic team, as well as the debtors' financial advisors, Eisner Amper, to vet the documents and the debtors' records. But you are also a check to see if those records are accurate. If your records show something different, your proof of claim shows something different, then the information will be reconciled ultimately between your information and the debtors. And if there's a dispute, the court will decide whether or not you're owed 50,000, 100,000, 100 million, whatever the number is, that number will be decided by the court if there's a dispute. Why weren't Thomas Salzano and Arthur Scutori, that's what it says, having been involved in two prior frauds-induced bankruptcies flagged by NJ Bureau of Securities and SEC? I can tell you that we are aware, both publicly as well as non-publicly, that the Bureau of Securities and the SEC were in fact investigating the company. And were aware of Salzano, not necessarily immediately, but certainly well before the bankruptcy in early 2021. So, you know, short of knowing what they do at the government, just like we all do, I don't know, but certainly pre-bankruptcy, there were investigations going on, and it's well reported in the press that they were deposed by, for example, or investigated and testimony was taken of them by the Bureau of Securities, and they took the Fifth. So they were investigated. What prompted NRIA to bring the independent manager? What made them know they had a problem? I think I mentioned that and described that earlier when Casey's appointment, largely because of the regulatory investigations. When will a turnaround plan be ready for review and filed? That, like I mentioned, is in process. Takes a lot of work. We need the schedules and proofs of claims. We need to work through an analysis of how those claims will be treated, and that is in process. As I mentioned, that's also tied to exclusivity. So we would anticipate a plan to be matured, certainly up to a point where it could be filed as early as later this year. When will the misappropriated money be returned? That is a subject of likely investigation and litigation. There may be some low-hanging fruit, meaning assets that are clearly identifiable that we can chase. There are some assets that we are seeing as potentially more attackable, more reachable, but that is the subject indefinitely of a court determining that those assets should be turned over. And so the investigation has to mature, the complaints and causes of action have to be filed, and then we'll get those assets back. So it's not sure, but that is a high priority for sure. How long of a process is the anticipated to be before we investors know what we can expect as far as return of funds? As I mentioned, it's unsure. It is a process that will take time, but it is tied to the real estate analysis. What will be the value of that real estate? Can it be realized? What will be the sales interests of those properties? Will it be a global sale? I mean, if we found a buyer who said, look, I'll buy all the assets for $450 million, then we'll know a greater certainty of what that number is. If we commence litigation and it shows that we'll be able to recover $50 million pretty quickly, then we'll know what that is. But we don't know that yet. 2 months into this, we're still working on it, but there is going to be an answer, hopefully in the near future. What is the possibility or probability of the Chapter 7 motion passing, given analysis for 11 versus 7? Like I mentioned, the conversion to Chapter 7 motion is really focused on just getting compelling the debtor to file the schedules. That motion will be withdrawn as stated in the motion if the schedules are filed, which we anticipate they will be. We had a call with debtors counsel today and they said they will be filed on or before the 4th. So hopefully that will be withdrawn. The analysis of 11 versus 7 ties to the real estate analysis we talked about, which is how these values are best done. In Chapter 7, it's liquidation. Trustee is appointed. They sell everything in a sale through court ordered sales, just put them up for sale, and no development is done. So the analysis, and I can tell you that the analysis on some of these properties is that they should be developed according to what we're hearing from the CRO. And therefore, if they're developed, there may be greater value than just liquidating. So that analysis is being concluded, but it's not concluded yet. Are we headed towards liquidation? Same answer. If the original funds were qualified tax deferred, should I leave the trust open? That is unfortunately a very individual question. You need your tax and estate planning person to answer. When will we know if I'm going to get 100 cents of my investment? Same answer as earlier, still in the process of being done. Why NRA is delaying to submit financial affair documents and restructuring plan? How much information we as the investor committee team have? There is no investor committee, just so we're clear. There's a creditors committee comprised largely of investors, but also trade creditors. The books and records at the petition date were in disarray. Both Eisner as well as Alvarez have been attempting to unravel those books and records, understand what happened, and decide what those financial affairs really look like. The debtor was delayed because they didn't do that work substantially pre-petition, have been doing so post-petition, and there are 132 entities they need to unscramble. So they've been doing that. Admittedly, it should have been filed earlier. We agree with the debtor, with the U.S. trustee, that the debtors should have filed those records earlier, but they haven't, and that's where we are. We, however, as far as Alvarez and Ice Miller are given and have been given through the committee, for the committee, access to the books and records of the company for our independent analysis and working with them on the real estate. So we do have access to that financial information. Obviously, like I said, it needed to be deciphered. Next, how much net assets are there? Are we supporting Chapter 7? Do all investors need to get an attorney? So the answer is, we talked about the assets. The schedules will tell us what the debtors believe they are, and we'll have those in short order, as I mentioned. We're not supporting Chapter 7 at this time. And as to whether or not you need to get an attorney, that's your independent decision. And if you have concerns about how to file your claim, seek your own counsel on that. It may be beneficial to you. Is there a better return to investors if they have an attorney? Not necessarily, but sometimes, depending upon the complexities of your case. I know that's a silly lawyer answer, but the reality is it depends upon your situation. If you gave $100,000 on a general unsecured note and you're comfortable with it and you get the debtor schedules and it says you're not disputed, not contingent, and it says $100,000, then maybe you don't have to, but ask a lawyer for yourself on that question. We can't, unfortunately, give you that advice. When will source and use of $650 million be done? When will analysis of each deal salvage be done? That again is part of the earlier answer about the analysis is underway, and it is obviously a high priority. What is the best way to keep up with the most current info and contacts for current updates? These town halls will be done and on the schedule that we reflected on the Omni website. The Omni website has information. You can register on that and you will get literal updates on the as pleadings are filed. You will get an email or a text, I don't remember which. You'll get a notification of filing. So that is a good way to get very timely updates. You can also, if you're individually or through counsel, file a notice of appearance. A notice of appearance puts you on record as saying that you're a party desiring to have notice of filings and substantive issues. That is a way of doing it also. So it's a document. You can look on the docket. There's other notice of appearances. You could do that. Will I get my money back? That is the golden question, right? And the answer is the professionals on this case, quite frankly, you can ask my wife, I never see her. We work 24/7 to get to on this case. And we try very hard, as does the Alvarez team, as does the entire committee, to make sure you get, and as does Rick and Greg, to try to get you this money. When will we be getting our letter spelling out how much we are owed? We need this to file a claim. Those are probably what you mean as the schedules. The schedules will be filed, as I mentioned, by the 4th. There is no letter, but there will be a filing. Look at schedules E and F to see where you are on those schedules, in particular for unsecured creditors, to see where you fall. How do we file an objection to the U.S. trustee's motion to liquidate assets? You can file an objection by filing it with the bankruptcy court. You could do that, but usually you need counsel to file it on the docket through a PACER filing, or you can do it through submission to the U.S. Bankruptcy Court Clerk's Office. But you should speak to your own lawyer about how to file that objection. How can the money burn be controlled? As I mentioned, that is part of our job as well, is making sure that there's efficiency, that there are only those people necessary to do the tasks. The committee is on top of this all the time, on top of us, its professionals, all the time. They are painfully aware. The committee is comprised of people like you, so they are painfully aware, and the burn is being kept at a minimum to the best of our possible ability. And more importantly is there's also going to be possibly a fee examiner. They'll keep controls over the fees, and the bankruptcy court will, of course, and is always cognizant of these costs. So there's going to be control, and no one wants to expend money unnecessarily. We really do want to maximize your return. Please provide detail of all property cost and status, which property will decide to sell and stage and value. As I mentioned, that's part of the analysis and is ongoing. Some investors have a guaranteed rate of return of 10% or 12%. If that is the case, does that raise that investor status to a creditor? As I mentioned, we cannot give individual advice to your individual claims, but generally speaking, so speak to your own counsel, it's your documents, but generally speaking, if a person has a general guarantee of an obligation that is owed, that guarantee, if not secured by real estate or other property, is a general unsecured claim against the estate. So speak to your own counsel. Guarantees may very well, depending upon your documents, constitute a unsecured claim against the estate. What do they see this will come to a head, start addressing refunds to investors? That timeline relates to the plan. It relates, and I'm reading your questions verbatim, so I apologize, but these may include the plan process and the real estate plan process. So we're looking at potentially not really knowing till later this year or early 2023 as to what those returns will be. Litigation will take longer and the investigation will take longer. Next question is, do you only include original investment less amount received on the claim, or do you include the guaranteed rate of return as well? There are two sides of this. One is you have to, your documents and your specific investment, whether you have a joint venture agreement, whether you have a guarantee, whether you have pure investment through the PPMs or the private placement memorandum, you have to speak to your own counsel as to how to file your proof of claim and what the claim should be. The other side of it is that the debtors and the committee are looking at each at these categories of investments and how they should, as a matter of law, be treated. Obviously, our objective is to maximize the return to investors and creditors. So we're going to look at it in a way that's most favorable, we hope, for investors and creditors, how those claims are treated. So there's two sides. Make sure you file your proof of claim, attach the documents that you need to support your proof of claim, and with the advice of counsel, and the analysis will be done on the other end to vet those claims in a way that hopefully is governed by the bankruptcy code and applicable law. Those are all the questions that we have here, and we appreciate it. We wanted to keep it to an hour. I spilled a little over, and we hope that this was helpful. There will be future calls. Some questions that we've seen in the comments, we don't have time to address right now, but we hopefully covered some of it. We will, however, take note of those questions in the comments, and in the future may in fact provide some presentations with schedules as to the status of the properties, where they are in development, et cetera. But obviously we wanted to make this the first introductory call, and I hope it was helpful. We're doing our best, and we wish you the very best, and we'll do everything we can. Mike, you have a question?
Yeah, if I just may make one point. In order to attend these town halls, you have to register, unfortunately, for each one individually. So please do not forget to register. We will send out an email to all the email addresses we have to remind people to register, but you have to register. There's a link on the Omni site. There, the notice that was filed on Friday lists all the dates. If you go to the Omni site in the right-hand side, there's a creditors committee box. In that box, there is a creditors committee town hall link where you can click there, and that has all the links for all the registration window. It has all the registration links. So you can just register for all of them at once at that point by clicking through each of the links and registering. So just wanted to remind everyone to do that.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Mike. That's important. Also, just so you know, because we are still working on projects and reports that have great detail in it as to the properties, from a very high level perspective, if you want to see which properties are under development, which properties are pre-development, which properties are under contract, you can take a look at the application filed by the debtor at docket number 616, page, it is in the auto, OTTEAU group filing. It's the first page, property descriptions, NRIA portfolio valuation. You'll see schedules of properties. If you wanted to look at that, that is on the docket at 616, and that schedule is available now publicly. So,
One last question. We received quite a bit. We will be looking into posting the recording of this webinar, of this town hall. We're looking into that. We'll get back with information as soon as we can. But keep checking the Omni website, because if we do post it, that's where it will be.
All right. Well, thank you all very much.
Yes, I have two other points I want to make. I was on mute, so I couldn't do it when you were answering a question. But first of all, I understand that the K-1s will be mailed. They will not be sent electronically. So just so you all understand that, by this Friday, that is what the debtors are telling us. Secondly, as it relates to the cash burn, the debtors and A&M speak weekly, and we review the reports that they provide to us identifying where the money is going, and we check it against our understanding as it relates to the properties that are under construction and the anticipated expenditures. So we do have a check-in and review and analyze that, and that also coincides with our work on the contract assumption.
Thank you very much, Ann.
It was required. So just wanted to clarify that.
Thanks, Andrew. Sorry, I lost you for a sec. Sorry, thank you. All right. Well, thank you, everyone, and have a good rest of your week, and we will talk to you all soon again.